Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway Studio in East County. Today we open our show with some national headline news from Public News Service, including an update on Hillary Clinton's latest email controversies, a major case on transgender rights heading to the Supreme Court, a verdict in the Bundy militants' occupation of public lands, renewal information on the Affordable Care Act, and a warning for Medicare patients on how to avoid fraud. Next up, we'll have top East County news, including information on an FAA meeting Tuesday in Spring Valley about proposed changes that could bring a lot more air traffic over some local communities here. We'll also have news about openings on the Spring Valley Community Planning Group, and an update on actions planned by Hamul residents concerned about accidents since a casino opened along Highway 94, as well as a report on fire risk in the backcountry, and a program bringing welcome relief for homeowners with dry wells in our region. Our newsmaker interview today is with Brett Hutchinson. He's an arborist who will be sharing updates on a devastating beetle infestation that's killing many thousands of oak trees locally, and what you can do to help protect our oak forests. On the second half of our show today, we have a Halloween treat in store for you with some local East County ghost stories. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Welcome to the Public News Service. I'm Mary Sherman. We're covering a variety of stories, including Hillary Clinton calls on the FBI to release all information into an email investigation, the Supreme Court set to take up bathroom rules for transgender students, and some unknowns as open enrollment approaches for the federal insurance marketplace. Our top story, Hillary Clinton said she is confident that the FBI will not recommend charges following news that the FBI is reviewing newly discovered emails tied to its investigation of her handling of classified materials. The FBI informed Congress Friday it is investigating whether there is classified information in new Clinton emails that have emerged. In July, the agency had said its investigation of Clinton's private server was finished. Clinton responded to the news at a press conference in Des Moines, Iowa.
We are calling on the FBI to release all the information that it has. Even Director Comey noted that this new information may not be significant, so let's get it out.
Clinton also tried to downplay the significance of the development occurring just 11 days before most Americans go to the polls. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump applauded the FBI's decision. The Supreme Court said Friday that it will decide whether the Obama administration may require public school systems to let transgender students use bathrooms that align with their gender identity. School districts around the country are split on how to accommodate transgender students amid conflicting guidance from courts, the federal government, and in some cases, state legislatures that have passed laws requiring people to use public restrooms that match the sex on their birth certificates. U.S. prosecutors on Friday regrouped to strategize for their next trial of armed militants who occupied a wildlife center in Oregon the day after seven others that related trial were surprisingly acquitted of all charges. The group's leader, Amon Bundy, and six others were declared not guilty of conspiracy charges stemming from their role in the armed takeover and 41-day occupation of the National Wildlife Refuge. The group was protesting federal land policies in the West, arguing for local control. But Chris Sager with the Western Values Project contends keeping national lands open and accessible for all Americans drives a multi-billion dollar recreation economy.
If you lose that because those lands are ultimately sold off to powerful special interests, then you lose a very significant chunk of the outdoor economy and, more importantly, our way of life.
The trial lasted nearly 6 weeks. The jury returned its verdict after less than 6 hours of deliberations on Thursday. Sign-ups for insurance coverage under the Affordable Care Act open on November 1st, and in some states, there are a lot of unknowns. Jerry Oster has more.
Alexa Raymond is a navigator with the Rural Office of Community Services in Lake Andes.
At this point, we do not have a provider list available to us to let us know which providers are going to be in which network. So it's really still kind of up in the air. We're hoping to get it out soon. So we have that information for November 1st.
The two major health insurance providers in the state, Sanford Health and Avera Health, have decided not to allow the use of their network by those holding outside coverage. That puts geographic limitations on the coverage available.
Treat your Medicare number just like your Social Security number. That's the message from consumer advocates who warn that letting your number get in the wrong hands could open you up to risk of fraud.
Treat your Medicare number just like your Social Security number. That's the message from consumer advocates who warn that letting your number get in the wrong hands could open you up to risk of fraud. If put in the wrong hands, people may use your card to claim health benefits or access personal information. Claire Marsalis with the Tennessee Department of Commerce and Insurance says it's important to exercise caution.
Protect your Medicare number like your credit card number, not giving it out to people, keeping it protected. Be wary of people who knock on your door or call you uninvited and try to sell you medical supplies or plans.
Experts say you should never share your Medicare number with anyone who contacts you by phone or email, and that Medicare will never contact you for your personal information. This is Stephanie Carson reporting.
Mass wildlife extinction is currently underway on planet Earth. That's according to a new report from the World Wildlife Fund. The findings show if nothing substantially changes in the very immediate future, roughly two-thirds of the planet's vertebrate wildlife could be wiped out as soon as 2020. The report, which was released Thursday, shows Earth already having lost nearly 60% of its fish, mammals, birds, and reptiles since just 1970. I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener-supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
The Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, is hosting a meeting in Spring Valley on Tuesday about a proposal to change flight paths to both Lindbergh Field and Brown Field airports, and that could sharply increase airline traffic and noise over East County. The meeting will be at La Presa Middle School, that's located at 1001 Leland Street in Spring Valley, on Tuesday, November 1st from 6 to 9 p.m. Laura Lowe's, chair of the Spring Valley Community Planning Group, urges everyone in the area to attend and spread the word. She says, "It is my opinion that we may be due for many more airplanes over our community in the future if the FAA doesn't get good input." The FAA says the goal is to improve air safety and efficiency as part of the Southern California Metropolix project, which will replace many conventional air routes with satellite-based routes. Now, the original plan was to reroute air traffic over Point Loma, but after residents there raised concerns over increased jet noise over their community, the FAA rejected that proposal. If East County residents want to avoid increased air traffic noise and pollution over local neighborhoods, it's important to attend on Tuesday, bring neighbors, and speak out at the public meeting. Air traffic can also pose serious safety concerns for residents, as when the PSA Midair collision crashed into homes in a North Park neighborhood back in 1978. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The Spring Valley Community Planning Group is seeking two new members due to the resignations of two members. One is moving out of the area and the other has not stated a reason. Losing members has been a continual problem with the 13-person planning group, mainly due to people leaving the area. As long as there are 8 members to make a quorum, the planning group can conduct business, but it's important to fill the vacancies as soon as possible. If you want to have a say-so over planning decisions on projects such as housing developments, parks, and commercial sites, this is your opportunity to get involved. Any Spring Valley listeners interested in joining the group can attend a meeting at the Otay Water District headquarters at 2554 Sweetwater Springs Boulevard at 7 p.m. on the second and fourth Tuesdays of each month. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is Miriam Raftery with an update on traffic issues in Hamul. The good news is that traffic jams have eased up considerably since opening day at the Hollywood Casino in Hamul, when delays of up to 4 hours were reported. The traffic is now flowing much more smoothly. But neighbors remain concerned due to numerous accidents that have occurred along Highway 94 since the casino opened. The Hamul Action Committee hosted a community meeting on Thursday at the Hamul Primary School to discuss strategies for opposing an unrestricted liquor license for the casino, and that license will be on the agenda at a public hearing of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board next month. Now, other tribal casinos locally were not granted unlimited liquor licenses when they first opened. Some were dry casinos for the first year or so before being allowed to serve liquor in their restaurants. And unlike Vegas, many local casinos have refrained from pouring alcohol to patrons on the casino floor in an effort to prevent drunk driving.
The Hollywood Casino in Hamul, however, was allowed to serve alcohol on its casino floor starting on opening day, an action that some residents contend amounts to gambling with their lives.
This is Rebecca Williamson with a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. After 5 years of prolonged drought, San Diego County native plants, trees, and grasses are either extremely dry, dying out, or dead, raising the risk of more volatile fire conditions in a longer peak fire season. How volatile? CAL FIRE measures fuel moisture content twice a month from May to October to gauge how dire conditions are in the backcountry areas. CAL FIRE Forester Eric Just, who also serves with the San Diego County Fire Authority, says 5 years of below-average rainfall is definitely increasing die-off of our shrubs in the foothills and the mountains. When you have dead fuels, it will give us more of a fire issue. Firefighters deal with two types of fuels, the living portion of the vegetation or live fuels, and the portions that have died over the years or dead fuels. Currently, San Diego County is about 10% below average for the live fuel moisture. Not quite a historic low, but on track to get there. Once plants get below 65% fuel moisture in the live portions of the plant, they are in a critical stage and likely to burn easily. San Diego vegetation is holding fuel moisture now in the high 40s to the low 50s. Dead fuel moisture depends on current weather conditions and can range between 1 and 20% or so. Due to this much lower moisture content, dead fuels are primarily what carry a fire from one point to the next. It's not just dry brush that's at risk for burning. Much of our forest land in San Diego County has been consumed in the 2003 and 2007 wildfires, and not a lot of it is left. Oaks that survived those fires have come under attack from the gold-spotted oak borer. Just estimates that at least 75,000 to 95,000 acres have been lost, dramatically altering our oak woodland forest here in San Diego County. Dead trees mean fires burn hotter and spread faster. Also, shade from oak canopies keeps brush from growing underneath. But if a tree dies and flammable native vegetation and grasses move on, the area is more susceptible to fire. CAL FIRE foresters also help carry out prescribed burns, create fuel breaks, cut defensible space around communities, and oversee fuel reduction projects to reduce fire danger. Property owners can help reduce fire risk by creating and maintaining a minimum of 100 feet of defensible space around their homes. Defensible space includes cutting out and removing all dead fuels and thinning out their surrounding vegetation. To learn more, visit ReadySanDiego.org.
Across East County, many property owners have been struggling after their wells have run dry. If you own property in San Diego County with a dry well due to the drought, here's some good news, finally. A new emergency water distribution program is offering to help residents without access to running water for drinking and sanitation due to a dry well. In addition, residents who qualify can receive low-interest loans to replace individual water well systems and install temporary water tanks. The water assistance is not for landscaping or agricultural needs. The program was created through an executive order issued by Governor Jerry Brown. Local assistance is available through the County of San Diego and the Rural Community Assistance Corporation. For a low-interest loan, applicants must own and occupy the property or plan to purchase the property with the dry well, and they must earn an annual gross household income of $62,883 or less. For the emergency water distribution program, applicants must own a property with a well that has gone dry due to the drought and live on that property. They must also earn a total gross monthly household income of no more than 200% of the federal poverty level and have plans for a long-term water supply solution. For more information, you can visit ReadySanDiego.org/emergency water. That's ReadySanDiego.org/emergency water or call 858-565-3490. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ. This is Miriam Raftery. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
Hello, everyone. This is Janice Russell with East County Magazine, and I'm here with Brett Hutchinson, a certified arborist from Green Tree Forest Service, and he was at a recent oak tree seminar in Hamul with another expert speaking about the oak trees and why they are dying so much. So Brett, when did oak trees start dying, and why are so many dying?
You have to look back at the bigger picture, you know, where San Diego County has been in a pretty severe drought for many years now. And not just oak trees, but all trees around the whole county are suffering from drought stress and other issues. In particular, the oak trees, once they've gone into drought stress, they're fairly susceptible to beetle infestation. And we have a variety of different beetles now in our area, both new and old beetles, that are having a pretty dramatic effect on the oak trees around the whole county.
Do you know how many trees in our region have died, and if there's an estimate of how many are infected?
Some of the most recent UC Riverside research suggests that there's approximately 120,000 acres of oak woodland in San Diego County alone that is in serious has serious beetle infestation going on. And on average, most of these areas, you can have anywhere from one tree to 30 trees per acre based on the density of the woodland. And a lot of these areas, we've had anywhere from 50 to even 90% mortality of these trees. So, you know, if you calculate that out, that we've lost well over 100,000 trees just in San Diego County alone.
Wow, that's a big number. Is there a way to prevent trees from getting infested with these beetles, and how do you tell if it's infested?
Most of the time, these trees are suffering from drought stress. That predisposes them to beetle attack. And there are approximately, and we're talking about oak trees now, there are approximately three main beetles that are hitting our oak trees. There's the gold-spotted oak borer, which is a fairly new invasive species that's been spreading into San Diego County for about 14 or 15 years now. And then there's the western oak bark beetle, which is an indigenous beetle to most of the western United States that is also present in high numbers in our forest. And then the other latest one is the polyphagous shothole borer, which is having an effect on many different species of trees in our region. So you really have to start by looking at the different beetles and understanding a little bit about their life cycles and how that affects the trees in your area. If you want to start with the gold-spotted oak borer is a new beetle that has traveled into our county. It's come into our county basically in the southeast corner, and it was believed to have made it across the desert to the east of us on truckloads of unseasoned firewood coming from the Arizona area. And this beetle has a one-year life cycle. It usually basically starts in the early spring with the female laying eggs on the outer bark of the tree, and then the larva bores down to the cambium, where it spends most of the summer feeding on the cambium zone, which is the junction between the bark and the wood of the tree. Is the active growing portion where the tree's moving sugars back down. So it's obviously the most nutritious zone for these beetles to feed on. So this larva feeds on that zone throughout the summer, and then by fall it's usually done, and it'll then migrate out to the outer bark where it digs out a chamber and will sit there in hibernation basically throughout the winter. Then the following spring, that larva senses the warmer days, begins pupation, and turns into the beetle. And then around early spring, the beetle chews its way out and begins the whole life cycle over again. So that particular beetle, because of its ability to hibernate in wood for long periods of time through the winter, that's the main reason why that particular beetle has been jumping around the county, and actually is the main reason why how it came into our county, because people are moving firewood that has active larva in it, and they don't realize that. And then this beetle can jump large distances in a very short amount of time. The natural spread of this beetle is usually only a matter of a few hundred yards per year, if it's not facilitated through human movement. So that's the gold-spotted oak borer. The western oak bark beetle, which is the indigenous oak beetle that's been in this area for years, that's a very small beetle that has a slightly different life cycle. It has a short life cycle. It can go through 2 to 3 generations a year in our climate. And that particular beetle will attack a drought stress tree and bore into the cambium layer where the actual beetle itself bores into the tree instead of just the larva. And then the female will lay a little pocket of eggs of 25 to 30 eggs in a small little spot. Those eggs hatch, and then The larva and the adult beetles will feed on the cambium layer basically until the tree succumbs and dies. Those beetles also bring along a couple species of fungi that this fungus, once initiated, it travels into the xylem and clogs the xylem of the tree, which is where the tree is moving water, and it shuts down basically the whole circulation of the tree, and you'll have a oak tree that'll turn brown in a matter of a month, and that's usually the combined action of the beetle and the fungus. And then the last beetle that I mentioned was the polyphagous shottle borer. That's another new beetle that's been coming into this area. It's been spreading around San Diego, and it has a similar activity to the western oak bark beetle, where the beetle itself bores into the tree and travels not into the xylem, not into the cambium layer, but it actually travels into the xylem where the tree's moving water. It actually bores and forms galleries where it lays eggs and raises its, the young basically in these chambers. And that beetle also brings along a fungus that shuts down the tree's ability to move water. It's basically a fusarium, dieback type wilt in it. And it's very devastating. And the shottle borer, unfortunately, it's not species selective as some of the oak beetles are. This new beetle is devastating trees all across our county now, and from willows to sycamores and oak trees and fruit trees, avocados. It's a very long list of trees that beetle will hit.
Okay, wow. Thank you for sharing. And is there any way to treat, cure, or at least slow down the damage?
Well, the biggest thing you have to do is keep your trees healthy, meaning do all you can to promote their health. Look at the environment where your tree is growing. Try to minimize, root impact, soil compaction in the root zone. It's good to keep, a certain amount of mulch around all your trees. But the biggest factor is hydration. All of our trees, both, in residential areas and out in the forest, are going through drought stress right now. And the easiest thing really to keep your tree healthy is literally to just water it. And that can prevent a whole host of problems. An oak tree, generally, in the past, people would tell you not to water oak trees. And that in most cases is true because you can accentuate root rot. However, right now, when our trees are in such hard drought stress because of lack of rain, they are more susceptible to attracting beetles and having problems with beetle attack because of drought stress than they are from having a root problem if you were to water it. So adequate hydration is the big thing, and then also keep an eye on your trees to make sure that they haven't been attacked by beetles. Some of the easiest ways to tell if your trees have been attacked are usually signs of lesions. It's usually a small, dark, wet, oozing spot on the outer bark. And if you inspect it, sometimes there's a little small entry hole related to it. And if you only have maybe one of those, that might not be an issue. But if you look at your tree and you have a 4 or 5 or 10 or 100 of those kind of things showing up, then your tree may be under major attack and need even further treatment.
Okay. And then you mentioned earlier about people transporting firewood. So what can people do instead of transporting it?
If you have a tree that you know has died because of a beetle attack, the one thing you have to do in order to try to slow down the populations of beetles that may be in your area, you need to act on a dead tree, if it's an oak tree especially, as soon as possible. Because the moment these trees turn brown, that's when they have the highest level of beetle and larva activity going on in them. And if people don't take activity right away, then that tree will eventually start to dry out, and the beetles sense that, and they wrap up their life cycle and move on to another green tree. So if you want to keep your trees healthy and your beetle populations low, when you have trees that die, you need to cut them down as soon as possible. Cut all the if you want to save the firewood, then you would cut everything down to firewood that you want to save. Any brush or branch debris that you don't want should be either chipped immediately, burned, or sent to some sort of, solid waste landfill, so that way you don't allow those beetles to spread from that material. And the firewood, if you have a tree that just died recently and still has active beetles in the wood, you would basically cut it up to firewood size, split it if possible, all the way down to firewood size split, and then you would put it in a sunny location and cover it with clear visqueen for approximately 3 to 5 months. And beetles can chew through plastic, so it's not 100% that you're going to catch everything, but if you take the time to cover it all the way to the ground and secure it to the ground all the way around the pile, the sun will penetrate the clear UV plastic and heat up the wood inside, and you can reach fairly hot temperatures underneath the plastic, which facilitates the drying out of the firewood. And the faster that wood dries out, the faster the beetles will either be killed or they'll be forced to wrap up their life cycle and try to move on. And in which case, hopefully encapsulate them and catch them. You don't want to leave a pile of wood that has active beetles in it just out in the open, or you've done basically nothing. The beetles will finish their life cycle and move out of that wood and fly onto the very next tree they can find that's, you know, susceptible. So,
are there any natural predators?
There are. We have a variety of different carnivorous insects, and even birds such as woodpeckers are very aggressive at foraging for a variety of these different beetles when they're at different stages of the life cycle. The woodpeckers have in our area have figured out that the gold-spotted oak borer spends a certain portion of its time out near the outer bark, and they figured out that at the certain times of year they can find, you know, this larva right underneath the bark and use it as their food source. The insects that we have two main insects that are carnivorous. There's a blue metallic beetle, and then there's also a red lace beetle. Both of these beetles have both their larvae carnivorous. The beetle lays an egg in the cavity where there's other beetle activity, and its larva hatches, and the larva actually tunnels down in the same tunnels that the bad beetles basically are in, and catches up with them and eats them. Problem is, though, is that if you look at the whole relationship between herbivores and carnivores, the carnivores are always one step behind the herbivores, meaning if you have a whole herd of cows out in the meadow, there's only a few coyotes following them, and there's usually not enough to have a significant impact on the populations. So that's the same way it is with our insects. We do have natural predators out there, but they are one step behind the wave of larger beetles that are actually attacking and killing the trees.
Is there any longer-term cure on the horizon?
Pray for rain. it all comes down to the climate and how much rain we get in certain areas over the years. And average rainfall has been dropping around the county for a long time. And unfortunately, that's whether it's you call it global warming or climate change, it is changing, and these things need to be addressed. So if you have oak trees in areas that are going through drought stress, and just so you know, one of the easiest ways to tell if an oak tree is in drought stress is it has crown thinning, and that's a state that the tree goes into as it goes into drought stress, where it begins to defoliate, so it slows down the amount of water it's moving through the system. So if you have trees that are in drought stress through crown thinning observations, you can either start watering them and just giving them a little more hydration. But there are also other things that we've been studying regarding insecticide application. There are products out there on the market that are available through a licensed applicator to use on the trunks of these trees that has the ability to both keep beetles out and also kill larvae and beetles when they try to come out of a tree if they're already in the tree. So those types of things have to be looked at on an individual basis, whether or not it fits the need of a particular tree's infestation and, you know, the area around it. Those products need to be applied at the right time of year to be successful, especially with the gold-spotted oak borer. Most of the best success with insecticide spraying for GSOB is in April, May, and June. You basically time the application of products with the emergence of the beetle, and it's very successful. We had really good results with that, with different products and using that type of technique.
Oh, good. And in your opinion, is it best to hire an arborist before trying to kill or get rid of these beetles on your own?
If you understand what you're looking at, a person can do plenty of good on their own as far as just keeping their trees healthy and doing what you can to keep the beetles from being able to attack your tree. But if you already have activity going on and you're unsure of what it is, it would definitely be good to hire a professional to come out and give you, you know, some sort of recommendation where they've actually truly identified what your problem is. There's a variety of other beetles that can have similar cycles. And if you aren't able to differentiate which one you have, you could get, you know, misdiagnosed in a sense and go down the wrong path with, the treatment that you're planning, you may try.
Okay. Is there anything else that you want to share with the listeners?
Overall, you know, if you're looking at tree health, whether it's out in the back country or whether you're down in a residential area, you know, as I said in the beginning, one of the biggest things that we've seen is trees becoming weak overall just due to drought stress. And even in residential areas, we're seeing that. And, you know, where we've had lots of cutbacks through the water districts where people have been forced to reduce their irrigation on their properties to 2 days a week and 10 minutes and, major cutbacks. And a lot of those policies were put in place to save water, but they weren't necessarily designed in a correct way to keep your large trees healthy. And we're seeing trees in residential areas that are succumbing to major drought stress just because of the fact that they've been forced to cut back their water so severely. We have people in Del Mar that went through some issues where they had to reduce their water and all their large pine trees in the area started dying one after another. And the pine trees can have the same type of beetle activity as the oaks, where once you have one tree die and it's fully infested, if you don't take care of it soon, that tree will manifest thousands of beetles, which will then move on and attack other trees that are in drought stress. And so a lot of these residential areas are realizing that if you have large trees, you can't let it get by on just 2 days a week of 10 minutes. Large trees need deep water. They need lots of water, deep water. And if you just are doing surface watering, meaning you're keeping your grass green, that's not enough to keep the tree healthy. And so, you got to reduce competition around these trees so they get more of the water and more of the nutrients and things they need to stay healthy.
Okay, thank you. This is Janice Russell with East County Magazine, and I just spoke with Brett Hutchinson, a certified arborist from Green Tree Forest Service. And you can read an article about the oak tree seminar he was at on www.eastcountymagazine.org. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
We have a special treat for you today for Halloween, some local East County ghost stories. East County has many reportedly haunted places. There are many stories of ghost soldiers haunting the former Army barracks in Campo, the final home of the famed Buffalo Soldiers Cavalry Brigade. The old Julian Hotel's original proprietor from the 1800s reportedly haunts the establishment, startling guests in his former room who have claimed he's even tried to climb into bed with them. Out at the old Vallecito stagecoach station, the ghost of a bride who never made it to the altar and died along the trail reportedly roams the premises searching for her lost love, clad in the wedding gown in which she was buried. And out along Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon Road, if you see a woman beckoning to you to follow her off the road, don't go. Witnesses have claimed she turns toward her victims to reveal no face at all, a dark specter intent on luring motorists off an embankment to their deaths on a roadway where many people have died. But the most spirited area in our region is the Anza Borrego Desert, according to many detailed stories of ghosts that reportedly haunt those lonely trails, mountains, and washes in that harsh, forbidding terrain. Storyteller Cactus Jim has written, "Many travelers, prospectors, and adventurers have gone into the desert never to return or be seen again. Others have returned with gold nuggets and treasures so rare that we could only dream of being so lucky ourselves. Desert lore, stories, and quests for loot and gold have made men greedy. Gunfights, murders, and death from starvation have left many dead on the barren desert trails. Their ghosts still walk the mountain ridges, gullies, and deserted locations they once traveled or lived, spirits with unfinished business who cannot rest. Some guard buried treasures and lost mines, while others battle perpetually until death, forever replaying their last moments of life, Cactus Jim wrote. So here are a few of the most haunting tales in that region, adapted from Desert USA and the Paranormal Blogspot.
In the 1860s, when stagecoaches were the primary means of cross-country travel, a special stage set out from El Paso, headed for San Diego, with a box of coins. The stage that carried the coins had one driver and a guard. When the stage reached Yuma, Arizona, the guard fell ill and the driver continued on without him. That same stage was held up by robbers somewhere in the area where the route meanders into Carrizo Wash in East County's desert region, between the Fish and the Coyote Mountains. The driver was shot during the robbery and the thieves stashed the coins in the south slope of Fish Mountain. The coins remain there to this day, they say, because there were too many soldiers passing by on the trail for the bandits to retrieve their loot. It is said that after the robbery, the dead driver and the stage continued through Carrizo, and after that, the stage disappeared, never to be seen again, at least not in an earthly form. But some witnesses say that the phantom stage still forges its way through the deep sand, pulled by a team of four mules on moonlit nights. The phantom stage is driven by a lone driver hunched over as if asleep. No passengers are seen on the stage when it passes through Carrizo Wash, hesitating only a moment, as if planning to stop where the Carrizo station once stood, though it's now only a pile of mud. The phantom stage continues on past the old station until out of sight. In the morning, you may think twice about whether you actually saw the phantom stage until you find ruts carved from wagon wheels and fresh hoof prints left behind by the ghostly stage that travels on occasion as if to keep the trail alive.
Vallecito is known for its ghost. Its history contains many murders, deaths, robberies, and other wicked tales. One well-known story involves a double murder at Vallecito Station. It all started with a stage holdup in which $65,000 worth of loot was stolen by four men on horseback who robbed the eastbound stage before reached Carrizo Wash en route to Vallecito Station. As the men fled the scene, the driver of the stage fired one shot, killing one of the four men. When he reached the thief he had shot, he found not one, but two dead bodies. The driver concluded that the leader of the band of thieves had shot one of his own men, so he would not have to divide up the loot. The bandit leader and one of the thieves survived the robbery and buried their loot in nearby hills, then rode on to Vallecito Station for a drink and some food. But the two bandits began to argue while having a drink. The leader of the outlaws went outside to check on his horse, promising to continue the discussion when he returned. He did return, entering through the doorway, mounted on his big white horse, and he shot his companion. As the wounded bandit was dying, he drew his gun and fired back at the leader, killing him off the back of his brave white horse. The white stallion, spooked by the gunfire and death of his master, ran off into the hills. It is said that when someone is in the valley, around midnight, near where the bandits buried their loot, the ghost of a white horse will appear from nowhere, galloping through the sand and then disappearing without a trace.
If you find yourself out late in the desert night, somewhere between the Superstition Mountains and the 17 Palms, you may see the apparition of an 8-foot glowing skeleton. A prospector by the name of Charlie Arizona first saw the ghost about 4 miles southeast of Borrego. It was a dark night when Charlie set up for camp. Just as he was settling down for the night, something disturbed his burrows. Hearing their frightened braying, he went to investigate. A shadow loomed large. Suddenly, he saw a large human skeleton with a lantern light shining right through its ribs. The skeleton walked in a crazy fashion, as if looking for something or as if it were lost. Heart pounded, Charlie watched, transfixed as the skeleton disappeared over the ridge. About 2 years later, two prospectors camping in Superstition Mountains caught sight of the flickering light in the distance and wondered what it was, but it quickly disappeared. One of the prospectors thought it looked like a skeleton carrying a lantern, but they figured it was just the fire reflecting off a rock. The two prospectors didn't think much of the incident until a year later, when a traveler came into the Vallecito station with the tail of a skeleton he saw wandering in the desert carrying a light. It wasn't long before the news of the skeleton got around, and two adventurers went out into the desert to search for this legendary skeleton ghost. During their third night in the desert, they encountered the ghastly lit skeleton. One of the men shot at it with a gun, but the skeleton continued on, unfazed by the gunfire. The two men followed the skeleton for 3 miles as it wandered in a strange and intermittent gait, over ridges and through valleys, before they lost track of it. Many believe that the skeleton is the ghost of a prospector who discovered and worked the Phantom Mine, which has been lost for many years. The skeleton is no better off than the rest of us, for he continues to search for the lost Phantom Mine, wandering the dark desert nights looking for his final resting place.
Not far from the Phantom Mine lies another place where skeletons have been seen. During warm summer nights, when the moon is full, ghosts dance at Yaqui Well. The ghosts are said to be the spirits of three emigrants who were traveling from Yuma to California. In search of a shorter route through the desert, the emigrants arrived at Yaqui Well, exhausted and near death from lack of food and water. One of the three travelers drank from the well as much water as he could hold. He died shortly thereafter. The other two men also drank from the well, but survived. While moving their dead companion's body, the other two noticed some rock specimens that fell out of his pocket. The two men were excited to discover the rocks contained gold, but they did not know where their friend had found the samples. Their excitement about the gold turned into greed and distrust. The two men began to struggle until one finally drowned the other in the muddy water of Yaqui Well. An Indian watched these events unfold from a nearby hill. He tried to talk to the man who had survived, but the emigrant was still so excited as he told his story that he entered a state of frenzy and ran off into the desert yelling, "Gold! Gold!" It is only during the hot summer nights of the full moon that the three emigrants return to Yaqui Well. One rises out of the muddy waters of the Yaqui Well. One emerges from the brush nearby, and the third arrives in the cool breeze out of the wash. The ghosts join hands and circle Yaqui Well in a dance. Soon after the twirling begins, they disappear, leaving only the good waters of the well and a slight chill in the air.
In the 1800s, many stories began circulating about a ship lying half buried in the sands of the Anza Borrego Desert, and some say its spectral sails unfurl at times on a ghostly voyage, its phantom crew seeking their way back home. After the Civil War, many migrants who passed through the desert on their way to California reported seeing a Spanish galleon with multiple masts and swore this was no mirage. Most claimed that it was loaded with a fortune's worth of exquisite pearls. Many expeditions sought to retrieve these riches, but so far, none have succeeded. As the story goes, in 1610, King Philip III of Spain ordered Alvarez de Cordone to search off Mexico's coast and bring back pearls. Cordone hired two other captains, Juan de Iturbe and Pedro de Rosales. He also hired 60 pearl divers and had 3 ships built. In 1612, they set sail to plunder Mexico's west coast of its precious oysters. The ship paused repeatedly in its travels so that pearl divers could jump off and return with oysters they discovered on the ocean floor. Later, they found a village where Native Americans had baskets of pearls just lying about. The Spaniards arranged a trade of their fancy European clothing for the pearls, but instead swindled the Native Americans by giving them only rags and dirty cloths. Outraged, the Indians attacked the ship as it was trying to set sail. Cordone was hit by an arrow, and his ship was forced to turn around, but he ordered the other two ships on in the search of more pearls, commanding them to look north in the Gulf of California. As they journeyed up the Gulf, Rosales' ship struck a reef in a terrible storm. Before it sank, the crew transferred the valuable cargo to Iturbe's vessel, which sailed up the Gulf and eventually up the Colorado River and into the Salton Sea, or Lake Cahuilla, as it may have been called long ago. Some stories claim that the ship sailed into the Salton Sea to find the legendary Straits of Anian, an all-water route from the Gulf of California to the Gulf of Mexico. It's been said that the Salton Sea and the Colorado River ran high, filled with water during a flood that swept the ship into the vast inland sea. Some say that an earthquake happened, closing off escape. The captain was horrified to find the outlet to the ocean blocked. Water in the lake was swiftly evaporating. Soon the ship was beached on the California desert, many miles from the sea. The crew grabbed what few supplies they could carry and abandoned ship, trudging westwards toward the water. As the story goes, the survivors were finally picked up. Other versions of the tale involve a pirate ship loaded down with almost 1 million doubloons. Another story states that the ship was from King Solomon's navy, carrying the 10 lost tribes of Israel to North America. Another variation on this story claims that the Cahuilla Indians, knowing the Spanish were coming to take their riches and harm them, ambushed the Spanish party that came ashore. Then the tribe mounted a full attack on the galleon and after a fierce battle annihilated the entire crew. The Cahuillas began looting the ship of food and exotic items, but they could not move nor break into the heavy large iron chests in the hold. Then a storm brewed up, dousing the galleon. The Native Americans were forced to desert the ship, which broke from its anchor, drifted off into the storm, and sunk into the inland sea, taking its precious cargo with it. By the time the lake dried up years later, the ship had been long buried under tons of dirt, sand, and silt. How true could these stories be? Lake Cahuilla did exist in the 16th century and had a tribe of Native Americans living nearby. It is possible that a flood occurred connecting the Salton Sea to the Gulf of California. The area between the desert and the Gulf has the potential to be hit with massive flooding, as we know from Hurricane Kathleen in the 1970s, which sent a 10-foot-high wall of water across the desert floor. So yes, it is plausible a ship could have been carried in on the surge and stranded afterwards as water receded. The sheer number of stories told by both Native Americans and frontiersmen through the centuries suggests some truth to these lost ship tales. Expeditions in search of the lost treasure ship began in the 1800s, after travelers heard tales from Native Americans. Some claimed that the ship seen in the desert was haunted and could only be found at certain times of the year. In 1870, several Indians reported seeing the ship west of Dos Palmas. Later that year, the Los Angeles Star published a series of short stories about Charlie Klusker, who claimed to have located the ship and its broken masts. He was organizing expeditions to bring back the missing vessel, which he claimed was filled with crosses. It was reportedly 50 miles from Dos Palmas in a region of boiling mud springs. But there were no further updates, and Mr. Klusker appears to have simply disappeared, much like the elusive ship. In 1878, three German prospectors said they saw the ship around sundown, about 120 miles northwest of Yuma and 40 miles east of Indio. The sighting actually cost one of the prospectors their lives. The two survivors reported seeing an immense ship under full sail floating over the desert, sailing like a cloud into the sunset. The prospector who died went after it in the next morning, but never returned. A rescue party eventually found him dead from a lack of water, and strangely, he was completely nude. In 1905, a prospector named Butcherknife Ike claimed to have discovered a fossil ship buried in the sand dunes of Borrego Springs. And in 1915, a Yuma Indian arrived in one town paying for his merchandise with pearls. When questioned, he claimed to have spent the night in a strangely shaped wooden house that was partially covered by sand. The people he spoke to offered him several hundreds of dollars for the night if he would take them back there in the morning, but he vanished overnight with their money. In 1933, Antonio de Fierro Blanco wrote a book discussing the story of Tiburcio Mancerna, a young mule driver who claimed he came across the lost Spanish galleon way back in 1775. Back then, Tiburcio was a mule driver for explorer Juan Bautista de Anza, who was searching for a land route from Sonora to Alta California. The young mule driver said he went into the hold of the ship and actually saw a treasure trove of pearls, but was never able to relocate the evasive ship. Many treasure hunters have gone after the missing treasure of pearls, but none have brought back evidence of finding it. Perhaps because these are simply tall tales, or perhaps because the shifting sands of the desert at times reveal and at other times obscure the legendary lost ship. According to some storytellers, the ship itself, now bleached white and desiccated by the whipping sands, blown by the desert winds, has become a ghost. If you're out in the desert late some night, you may just see an eerie, otherworldly glow and hear the singing of those long-dead sailors, the skeleton of a ghost ship sailing into the sunset or adrift in the moonlight. Is the mysterious ship laden with the fortune and pearls still out there in the desert? Perhaps sailing spectrally over the sands? Perhaps one day, when the sands blow the right way, we'll be lucky enough to find out.
Now we have one last hair-raising tale to tell, and this one is about the mysterious giant black cats reported to be prowling the wilds of East County. A reader tells us that sightings of huge black cats the size of mountain lions or bigger date back at least to the 1980s, when witnesses described a black cougar near Highway 67 at the eastern end of Poway. Zoology experts claim there is no such thing as a black cougar or mountain lion, though they once said the same thing about black bobcats until one was killed by a car and proof positive was found that these once legendary animals existed. Another possibility is a black leopard, an exotic pet that's escaped. But a more likely explanation for the many sightings here is that there are black jaguars in northern Mexico, big cats that when fully grown can be much larger than mountain lions. An adult male can weigh up to 350 pounds, though females can be about the size of mountain lions and cubs even smaller. Jaguars have golden eyes, squared heads, and very powerful jaws capable of taking down a full-sized crocodile in the wild. Officially, jaguars have been extinct in California for decades. But have they returned? Or perhaps they never really left. Yet another possibility is that jaguars have bred with mountain lions. That, too, is thought to be impossible, scientists say, but they once thought wolves could not breed with coyotes, until DNA testing proved that they did, and frequently. Many of the early sightings in San Diego County of large black wildcats have been made close to the border, some very near a gap in the border fence in Hukumba Hot Springs, where the terrain was too rugged to connect the fence up. Howard Cook, the former head of Hukumba's planning group, told me there have been regular sightings in recent years of a big black cat believed to be a jaguar, and also what appears to be a golden black spotted jaguar at Lake Hukumba. Such a pair could give birth to cubs that could be either black or spotted. He believes the big cats crossed over from Mexico, and the town librarian's son also saw what he described as a black panther crossing Old Highway 80 and Boulevard some years ago, though there's technically no such thing as a black panther either, a term used by ordinary folks to describe any of several big black cats. Gene Garrity told us that he and a friend, both farm boys, were out hunting above Loveland Reservoir south of Alpine back in 1994, when a huge black cat crossed the road in front of them. The tail was very fat and very long, he said. We got out of my Jeep, and we were looking at the paw prints in the mud. They were huge, with very huge claw marks. I estimate the cat was close to 200 pounds or more, he said. Assistant Border Patrol Chief Rosario Pete Vasquez told me, I saw one on Mount Laguna maybe 20 years ago. It was daytime, and there was snow on the ground, so you could definitely tell it was all black. That big cat weighed about 100 pounds, he estimated. One winter night in 2011, the reader reported that a resident of Hapatul Valley south of Alpine, Warren Storm Thunder, claimed he saw a jaguarundi, a black cat from central Mexico that is a little smaller than a mountain lion. Sharon Cremosis, a rancher and a friend of mine, insists she saw a large black wild cat slightly smaller than a mountain lion while driving her golf cart on a ranch she owned in a remote area of Boulevard near the border. A neighbor of hers has also seen black wild cats, she told us, and she's also seen mountain lions and is confident in her description. Ariel Brook, one of our very own writers, who is also a teacher, saw a large black cat running across a roadway in Deerhorn Valley about a year ago. It looked like a black mountain lion and moved like a wild animal, she said, adding it had a long cat-like tail. In 2012, a resident of Aguanga near Warner Springs at the base of Cahuilla Mountain reported she heard her dogs going ballistic and walked outside to see a huge black cat perched on a boulder near her barn, which had a pig, a goat, and horses stabled inside. She said the cat was creeping up the rocks and had glistening circles of gray on its black fur. It was smaller than a mountain lion, and it sounds to us like a black jaguar cub, which could have spots faintly visible. On a blog post, she wrote that neighbors saw the same thing. And the Union Tribune published a report in December 2013 of a couple near Miramar Reservoir who claimed to see a large gray-black cat about 4.5 feet long that swiftly vanished into brush on a steep hill above the water. There have been many sightings locally, though none have been documented with photos, perhaps because these mysterious creatures move swiftly and are often spotted at night. Plus, frightened observers may be more concerned with not becoming dinner than with snapping a photo. We first reported on these mysterious black cat sightings back in 2014, and our readers deluged us with their tales. A reader in the Anza area, in the northeast part of our county, says there were several sightings in 2014 in her area as well. A Pine Valley reader said she was putting out food for a small feral cat in her gazebo one night when she was startled to see what looked like a panther with an unusually strong build, a big head and coal black fur that she believes was a jaguar. "I sure froze in my tracks," she told us, adding that she slowly backed up to her door just as the cat dug in its claws into the carpeting on the gazebo she'd been standing on a moment earlier and pulled up the carpet off the cement. On September 1st, that's just last month, Forest Service volunteers Peter and Chris Ruth wrote to warn us that hikers saw a large animal resembling a big black cat in a tree near Cedar Creek Falls in the Julian area, a popular hiking destination. Soon after, two women volunteers hiking the trail to pick up trash heard growling noises three times and promptly exited the area. Were those black jaguars? Or possibly black bears? Another species thought to be extinct here that have since been documented to have returned, though still rare. In 2013, a Border Patrol camera caught proof positive on an infrared camera in Inkapaw where a black bear ran across the road. But the big black cat sighting at Cedar Creek Falls becomes more plausible given a second big black cat sighting reported on October 26th, just days ago, to our news publication by Cameron Forbes, who says he and his son saw a giant black cat walking past a campground in broad daylight at Pines Anita in the Julian area, the size of a mountain lion or even bigger. These huge black predatory cats have also been seen in Spring Valley. Last year, a retired U.S. Navy chief, Manuel Domingsang, said he heard his chickens making noise and he went out to find a giant black cat inside the coop. It killed a chicken that night, and at 5 a.m. the next morning, he went out to check his coop and found the black cat back inside, and the rest of his chickens were dead. The large cat leaped over a fence right in front of him. 2 months later, a college professor, Dan Moody, told us that his mother, Dee Moody, a retired high school teacher, saw a jet black big cat weighing at least 70 pounds that sauntered across an open field beside her Spring Valley house in broad daylight. She described it as black and shiny, with a tail at least half as long as its body. And then on Christmas Day last year, a retired professor came across two dead coyotes at the end of her cul-de-sac on the eastern side of Dictionary Hill in Spring Valley. Their throats had been slashed, and the bodies were still warm. Only a very large predator, likely a huge cat, could have killed coyotes, which are themselves a predatory species. We do have coyotes across East County, and you may hear their mournful howls at night. But if you're walking out in the dark in East County, and you happen to catch a glimpse of a huge black shadowy cat, or hear the growl of a large animal, remember the sage advice of poet Ogden Nash, who wrote, "When called by a panther, don't anther."
We hope you've enjoyed these haunting tales from East County. We extend our special thanks to the participants in today's special presentation: Miriam Raftery, Leon Thompson, Navario Bell, Tasha Matthews, Liz Alper, and this is Ed Barena. From all of us at East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio, to all of you, our listeners, we wish you a chilling and thrilling Halloween. Happy haunting!
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.